Welcome, travelers, to the Philip K. Dick Philosophical Podcast. Slide yourself into a disassociative fugue, and let's begin.
You have returned to the Philip K. Dick Philosophical Podcast. This is our third episode, and we're looking at another short story from Mr. Kindred Dick. This one is called...
The Skull.
It's about a skull. And this one was written in 1952 and was published in IF magazine. My name is Adam, and I'm here with...
Phil. I'm the other guy in the room.
All right. So, The Skull. 1952, IF magazine, set in...
Midwest America.
Well, set across two places, actually. Future Midwest America and past...
It's not so much where, it's about when.
It's about when. This is our first Philip K. Dick time travel adventure.
Yeah, leading up to this, we've always been going to strange and unusual places. Right now, we're going from America to America.
Let's go.
What is this opportunity? Connor asked. Go on, I'm interested.
The room was silent. All faces were fixed on Conga, still in the drab prison uniform. The speaker leaned forward slowly. Before you went to prison, your trading business was paying well. All illegal, all very profitable. Now you have nothing, except the prospect of another 6 years in a cell. Conga scowled. There is a certain situation... Very important to this council that requires your peculiar abilities. Also, it is a situation you might find interesting. You are a hunter, were you not? You've done a great deal of trapping, hiding in the bushes, waiting at night for the game. I imagine hunting must be a source of satisfaction to you. The chase, the stalking. Conga sighed. His lips twisted. All right, he said. Leave that out. Get to the point. Who do you want me to kill? The speaker smiled. All in proper sequence, he said softly. The man you are after has been dead for 2 centuries, the speaker said. This is all that remains of him. For a long time, Conga said nothing. He stared down at the bones, dimly visible in the recess of the wall. How could a man dead centuries be killed? How could he be stalked, brought down? Conga was a hunter, a man who had lived as he pleased, where he pleased. He had kept himself alive by trading, bringing furs and pelts in from the provinces on his own ship, riding at high speed, slipping through the customs line around Earth. He had hunted in the great mountains of the moon. He had stalked through empty Martian cities. He had explored... The speaker said, Soldier, take these objects and have them carried to the car. Don't lose any part of them. The soldier went into the cupboard, reaching gingerly, squatting on his heels. It is my hope, the speaker continued softly to Conga, that you will demonstrate your loyalty to us now. There are always ways for citizens to restore themselves, to show their devotion to their society. For you, I think this would be a very good chance. I seriously doubt that a better one will come. And for your efforts, there will be quite a restitution, of course.
So, what we have here is a world divided. We have the state, which is a militarized version of government, and we have the church, which is the military's adversary, an ideological adversary.
Nice. It begins with a desecration. They're actually taking the skull of the founder of the church, which it's taken them, I think in the text it says, I can't remember exactly how long, but... many years, if not decades, to locate. It's been well hidden. It's obviously a precious religious relic. And they've stormed in into the church, stolen this skull, in order to effect this proposition, which, as it turns out, is they're going to send this pelt smuggler back in time to kill the founder of the church, so that there's no longer a separation between church and state. There's just state.
Which is essentially the ideological clash between reason and force over faith and will, heart and mind. big dichotomy.
It's a funny conundrum because the religion is a very peaceful religion, as we're taught. There's been no wars for two centuries, but the argument that the military makes is that you need wars to keep the population down and to bring about new innovation and generally for the human race to prosper. And without wars, things are kind of becoming a bit of a hippie paradise that's not very fun for the scientists.
The rumor spread. He had conquered death. He was divine. And here we are today with a first church, obstructing all social progress, destroying society, sowing the seeds of anarchy. But the wars, Connor said. About them? The wars? Well, there were no more wars. It must be acknowledged that the elimination of war was the direct result of non-violence practiced on a general scale. But we can take a more objective view of war today. What was so terrible about it? War had a profound selective value, perfectly in accord with the teachings of Darwin and Mendel and others. Without war, the mass of useless, incompetent mankind, without training or intelligence, is permitted to grow and expand unchecked. War acted to reduce their numbers. Like storms and earthquakes and droughts, it was nature's way of eliminating the unfit. Without war, the lower elements of mankind have increased all out of proportion. They threaten the educated few, those with scientific knowledge and training, the ones equipped to direct society. They have no regard for science or a scientific society based on reason. And this movement seeks to aid and abet them. Only when scientists are in full control can the... He looked at his watch and then kicked the car door open. I'll tell you the rest as we walk.
The peace movement has essentially lost already. And this is why these events are occurring.
Well, at this stage, I'd almost argue that the peace movement's winning. Because they seem quite on the... Like, science is somehow... These military industrial scientists have... They've got weapons, they've got soldiers, they've managed to get into the church. But they're kind of having to do it on the sly. They're not... They're certainly not all-powerful. And it seems that in the face of many, many people who follow this religion, they're finding it impossible to move forward.
True, but the religious, benevolent, how you describe them, hippies, dare I say, pacifists.
You dare.
The pacifists have lost their battle because they've essentially allowed the military to become this great might that seeks self-justification.
Well, certainly it's uneven in that the military have time travel and the religious do not. So it certainly seems if they can be successful in sending a mercenary back in time to erase, wipe the religion off the face of the earth, then they're going to turn out ahead. It even seems to me if this fails, if they've got that technology, they can just keep trying till it doesn't fail.
It does, but it always seems to me like a bit of a crapshoot. If you take into consideration Terminator, for example, going back in time to stop Skynet from becoming self-conscious, how do you know that you're actually not going to make Skynet become something even more evil or more ferocious? How do you know that you're ever going to end up with a time continuum that is beneficial? It's really a shot in the dark.
And I guess it is even more a shot in the dark because they kind of know where, but they don't know exactly. So they've got to kind of send this guy with the skull. That's the only way they can identify even who it is. There's no name given. The leader of this religion is kind of this figure that appeared for a brief period, had some teachings, was said to be risen from the dead, very similar to the Jesus myth, and, founded this religion. But that's really all they know about it. But he's up for this mission. Particularly, they give him a sweet gun. What was it? What did they call it? A sem gun or something?
Slem gun.
Slem gun. Yes. I believe the quote is, "This is a gun I could fall in love with." Nice. Shows he's classy. He's got class.
Uzi 9mm long sliding laser sight.
I can't help but think about, you know, he's got a bit of a quest for adventure. In the reading, it said he's gone through abandoned cities in Mars, and he's been through the mountains of the moon. There's obviously a bit of a draw for him on this mission, not just to kind of clear his name and be integrated back into society, but also to wield a kick-ass gun and do something no one's ever done before. And so he does it. He agrees, and they lead him to the time machine.
There is one thing here, though, and it's something I struggle with all science fiction and time travel based science fiction, in that there is this inception of an idea, and then the original motivation nullifies itself by going in time to erase what essentially brought about its existence. How can you be sure that an idea or a concept will travel through time, and by doing so, aren't you destroying the very genesis of that idea? It's a bit of a conundrum that I struggle to deal with.
It is a conundrum. Is that something they discuss in the text?
No, it's just a loose thematic thing that I've picked up on, I guess. It's amusing.
Oh, no, it isn't. I'm sorry. Well, I was listening and browsing because I had in the back of my head that it was mentioned, and it really is just one sentence. And it goes a little something like this. "Good luck," the speaker said. "We'll be awaiting the outcome. There's some philosophical doubt as to whether one can alter the past. This should answer the question once and for all." So, yeah, they don't know. This is brand new technology, and clearly this is the first thing they've decided to do with the technology. They, you know, didn't want to go back and work out how the pyramids were made or how cable television emerged.
But this is the thing I struggle to deal with. If their mission is successful, they cease to exist. If we actually take into consideration the time-space continuum set up by, say, Back to the Future, if you change the past, you erase the future.
Well, yes, and this is where you need parallel universes to make it all viable, perhaps. But at this point in the text, and that's kind of what's cool about it, no one knows. He's going on this mission and they have these similar... Well, not questions about their own existence. They seem pretty confident that, you know, only details are going to change. But they've kind of clearly said, yeah, we don't know if we can do anything or if the past will change. Yeah, maybe they don't ask it to quite as much depth as potentially you should before jettisoning back to make major changes in time.
Which I guess is the polar opposite to faith, really. You know, it's the ultimate question. It's the hypothesis. Whereas faith means that I believe in an absolute truth. Whereas questioning things and hypothesizing and experimenting things is the exact opposite, or the antithesis of faith.
Okay, so, well, he's clearly in the latter camp, and this is our reading.
Conger picked up the slim gun and held it against his cheek. The metal of the gun was cool and smooth. He practiced moving the sight. It was a beautiful gun, the kind of gun he could fall in love with. If he had owned such a gun in the Martian desert, on the long nights when he had lain, cramped and numbed with cold, waiting for things that moved through the darkness. He put the gun down and adjusted the meter readings of the cage. The spiraling mist was beginning to condense and settle. All at once, forms wavered and fluttered around him. Colors, sounds, movements filtered through the crystal wire. He clamped the controls off and stood up. He was on a ridge overlooking a small town. It was high noon. The air was crisp and bright. A few automobiles moved along a road. Off in the distance were some level fields. Conger went to the door and stepped outside. He sniffed the air. Then he went back into the cage. He stood before the mirror over the shelf, examining his features. He had trimmed his beard. They had not got him to cut it off, and his hair was neat. He was dressed in the clothing of the middle 20th century, the odd collar and coat, the shoes of animal hide. In his pocket was money of the times. That was important. Nothing more was needed. Nothing except his ability, his special cunning. But he had never used it in such a way before.
Yeah, that's interesting that his first... He arrives and his very first action is self-reflection. The beard becomes a thing. And I recall later on, if I can bust through with Hirsute-related spoilers, that beard marks him as someone a bit odd. No one in the town has beards.
That's right.
But every other aspect of his visage seemed pretty good. He had the animal hide shoes. I think they had put a bit of attention into detail.
Which comes up in the contents of his wallet.
Yeah. So let's push through to that. The first thing he does is he needs information. Obviously, he doesn't know exactly when this guy is going to emerge. And I believe he first goes to the newspaper or the library.
He finds the newspapers at the library.
Okay, so he finds newspapers and kind of looks for some kind of article that will talk about a stranger. And he finds that. And it turns out to be a number of weeks earlier.
Less than a month.
There's only one kind of weird occurrence where he is on his way back having found that information and is seen by someone who just looks completely shocked.
Her face turned white, I believe. Ashen.
He wonders maybe he's got some detail wrong. He trimmed his beard. Maybe, you know, he had his third robot eye still installed.
The onion tied to his belt?
Well, I don't know. Maybe that's the future. I always wear an onion tied to my belt, but, you know, I'm not from the 50s. But, you know, that's okay because he was headed back to the time machine and he's out of there. He jumps back in the machine and basically everything goes grey and then cuts to him looking for somewhere to stay. And he has found somewhere and the following exchange occurs.
The man looked him over critically. "You better come inside," he said, "out of the cold." "Thanks." Conger went gratefully through the open door into the living room. It was warm and close from the heat of the little kerosene heater in the corner. A woman, large and shapeless in her flowered dress, came from the kitchen. She and the man studied him critically. "It's a good room," the woman said. "I'm Mrs. Appleton. It's got heat. You need that this time of year." "Yes," he nodded, looking around. "You want to eat with us?" "What?" "You want to eat with us?" The man's brows knitted. "You're not a foreigner, are you, mister?" "No," he smiled. "I was born in this country, quite far west, though." "California?" "No," he hesitated. "In Oregon." "What's it like up there?" Mrs. Appleton asked. "I hear there's lots of trees and green. It's so barren here. I come from Chicago myself." "That's the Middle West," the man said to her. "You ain't no foreigner." "Oregon isn't foreign either," Conger said. "It's part of the United States." The man nodded absently. He was staring at Conger's clothing. "It's a funny suit you got on, mister," he said. "Where'd you get that?" Conger was lost. He shifted uneasily. "It's a good suit," he said. "Maybe I better go some other place if you don't want me here." They both raised their hands protestingly. The woman smiled at him.
"We just have to look out for those Reds. You know, the government is always warning us about them."
"The Reds?" He was puzzled.
"The government says they're all around. We're supposed to report anything strange or unusual. Anything doesn't act normal."
"Like me?" They looked embarrassed. "Well, you don't look like a Red to me," the man said. "But we have to be careful. The Tribune says..." Conger half listened. It was going to be easier than he thought. Clearly, he would know as soon as the founder appeared. These people, so suspicious of anything different, would be buzzing and gossiping and spreading the story. All he had to do was lie low and listen, down at the general store, perhaps. Or even here, in Mrs. Appleton's boarding house. "Can I see the room?" he said.
"Certainly."
Mrs. Appleton went to the stairs.
"I'll be glad to show it to you."
They went upstairs. It was colder upstairs, but not nearly as cold as outside. Nor as cold as nights on the Martian deserts. For that, he was grateful.
So what we've got here is Philip K. Dick's ongoing commentary on McCarthyism. Philip K. Dick was always paranoid of a totalitarian government's behaviour. We'll get back to the crux of things.
Well, it's such an interesting combination. He's comparing it to the Martian deserts, and it's kind of an equally weird place for him, at least. For these people, they've been taught and informed to just be completely suspicious of anything that is not familiar. And for him, his whole mission is to go to the furthest situation from familiar and act in that context. Nice kind of juxtaposition, I find, because they have common ground, but their motives and their backgrounds couldn't be any further from each other. It reminds me personally of the war on terrorism. I've seen ads saying, report any suspicious package, or, you know, that
if you see something, say something.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is in the context of Australia, where obviously we are. It's nice that they're in a boarding house, so rather than a headlong debate with two antithetical ideas crashing heads, it's actually a discussion between some people who are genuinely friendly and housing him and giving him a place to stay, and him who's a genuinely interested traveller. And
by essence, the boarding house invites strangers.
In terms of the mission, he's on the way. He's a bit cocky about the whole thing. He's like, I'll be able to spot a stranger very easily. Where he is actually Cooper Creek, and it's December 1960. So it's not 50th. He's now on the lookout for a stranger, for something, someone new to come in that is going to be the founder, the person who starts this religion. His port of call is the grocery store.
The funny thing about science fiction is it always seems to be a warning for the future. Science fiction writers tend to lay down what they think is potentially good advice to be heeded. George Orwell did it. Philip K. Dick did it. Everyone did it. I start to wonder if we're actually listening to science fiction well enough now time, because a lot of the things that they talked about and the horrific situations can arise if authority and power and totalitarianism and fascism become unchecked tend to pretty much manifest themselves if you look at it from the right angle. I don't know if we're listening to science fiction or not.
It's interesting that you raised 1984. I only actually read that for the first time recently, and that's a bleak tale. And probably one of the few moments where the future has some kind of redemptive quality is when there's a sense of human intimacy, and that kind of occurs in the context of a boy-girl relationship. And that's kind of what happens here. When he goes into the store, he meets Laura and gets along quite well. Conga moves to the main street of Cooper Creek, the small town, and passes by the soda fountain. He goes in for a drink.
You know what strikes me as somewhat amusing, that Cooper Creek is actually adjacent to Summer Bay in Home and Away.
Make of that what you will. He sees his lady in there. He sees her in there. She's having a chocolate milkshake with whipped cream, as 16-year-olds want to do at that time, I suppose. And so he joins her, and they start to talk.
You know, I can't help think that she's wearing bobby socks and pleated skirts and a ponytail and little shoes with a buckle. Maybe it's Happy Days, I'm not sure.
In which case, I think Conjo would surely be the Fonz. Cruising into town, looking stylish, has the women interested. This is a bit of a problem. He introduces himself as Omar, and she says, like Omar Khayyam, the poet.
Who was also a mathematician from the 14th century, Persian mathematician who actually wrote the treatise on algebra and algebraic functions.
Interesting, like another marrying of science and mysticism. But yes, so his Fonz-like entrance causes trouble when Bill, Laura's boyfriend, emerges on the scene. Mostly because Bill doesn't like... Well, it's a combo. Bill's jealous and he doesn't like foreigners or Oriental.
It's also very similar to the scene in Back to the Future where Biff accosts Marty McFly at the fountain. Which happens in both time periods, actually, except it was Biff's dad.
Well, you know, I associate fountain with source. Okay, so we've got Laura, she's swooning. She likes his out-of-town ways and mystical, algebraic charm. Bill doesn't like him for those same reasons, and starts to get more and more shirty. So Omar, let's call him Omar, I'm sick of saying Conja or Conga. So Omar gets hold of his little stunning device, sets it to half an amp, and nervously touches the trigger. And in fact, he doesn't mean to, but he actually sets it off. And they both get a bit stunned, and he strolls out rather quickly. Only to be accosted by the local sheriff soon after.
Surprisingly soon after, in fact.
Yeah.
In fact, I think there was a slip up in the timeline, a wrinkle in time, if you will.
Oh, news travels fast in small towns.
It really does.
So the sheriff is like, well, what are you doing? I heard there was, you know, something went down there. Have you got a bomb? And he feeds an entirely believable story that he had a cigarette lighter malfunction, thereby...
enveloping Laura and Bill.
Biff.
Sorry, Bill Willard in a cloud of fumes, which they were overcome by.
Yeah, smoke inhalation. Yeah. Well, I mean, I did leave the stove on and fall asleep the other day. Woke up to a cloud of metallic smoke.
Did you know that is also a cause of auditory hallucinations? And sometimes the presence of ghosts is actually based on, or presumed to be, natural gas leaks.
They didn't have hallucinations, but given it was only half an amp, they were shocked pretty hard. Or given that it was only the smoke from a cigarette lighter, they went down pretty quick. But, you know, I guess technology being what it was in the town of Cooper Creek, that was a feasible enough story. He got away with it.
Pause. The people back in his own time were diligent forgers. They had studied the documents of the past and done their best to actually make his documents seem as credible as they could.
Let's go to a reading.
He held the skull in his hands, turning it over. In spite of himself, a cold feeling rushed through him. This was the man's skull, the skull of the founder, who was still alive, who had come here this day, who would stand on the field not 50 yards away. What if he could see this, his own skull, yellow and corroded, 2 centuries old? Would he speak if he could see it, the grinning, aged skull? What would there be for him to say, to tell the people? What message could he bring? What action would not be futile when a man could look upon his own aged, yellowed skull? Better they should enjoy their temporary lives while they still had them to enjoy. A man who could hold his own skull in his hands would believe in few causes, few movements. Rather, he would preach the opposite. A sound. Conga dropped the skull back on the shelf and took up the gun. Outside, something was moving. He went quickly to the door, his heart beating. Was it he? Was it the founder, wandering by himself in the cold, looking for a place to speak? Was he meditating over his words, choosing his sentences? What if he could see what Conga had held?
So Omar's just had a little Hamlet moment, holding a skull, contemplating mortality. I don't know where I'm going with that.
Yeah, well, at this point, he's still pretty firmly... He's firmly focused on the mission to kill. He's in full assassination mode. But you see the first seeds of doubt coming in. You know, this comes up in other occasions in Philip K. Dick's work, is the idea of empathy. So he's fine to start assassinating the founder, but once he holds the skull and imagines that it's his own, suddenly the game changes a little bit and he starts to think what it would be like to experience. And I mean, having just gone through time, I guess these questions may have been deferred, but they were inevitably going to be asked.
And also the scientific implications of being able to hold your own skull, which means that you've actually created matter out of nothing and therefore have essentially introduced matter into another timeline or a dimension, according to most theories of parallel universes and time paradoxes. You can't actually occupy the same space as your former self.
Yeah, here it's less emphasis on the paradox and really just on the nihilism of it. It's like you can move around through time infinitely, but you're still going to stumble upon your own death and your own insignificance throughout that stream of time.
It's almost as though he's created a feedback loop of fatalism.
But to break this train of thought, Laura comes racing in, and she's got news. And the news is that the sheriff...
They's a coming to get you.
He pushed the door open, the gun raised. Laura, he stared at her. She was dressed in a wool jacket and boots, her hands in her pockets. A cloud of steam came from her mouth and nostrils. Her breast was rising and falling. Silently, they looked at each other. At last, Conger lowered the gun. "What is it?" he said. "What are you doing here?" She pointed. She did not seem able to speak. He frowned. What was wrong with her? "What is it?" he said. "What do you want?" He looked in the direction she had pointed.
"I don't see anything. They're coming."
"They? Who? Who are coming?"
"They are. The police. During the night, the sheriff had the state police send cars. All around, everywhere. Blocking the roads. There's about 60 of them coming. Some from town, some around behind."
She stopped, gasping.
They said...
"What?"
"They said you were some kind of communist."
Conger went into the cage. He put the gun down on the shelf and came back out. He leaped down and went to the girl. "Thanks. You came here to tell me? You don't believe it?"
"I don't know."
"Did you come alone?"
"No. Joe brought me in his truck from town."
"Joe? Who's he?"
"Joe French, the plumber. He's a friend of Dad's."
"Let's go.
His cigarette lighter excuse actually turned out to be a bit more flimsy than he thought. He hadn't really got away with it. The sheriff had decided he's a communist and had rounded up all and sundry. Laura had been driven with a friend of her dad's to come and warn him.
Joe French, the friendly plumber.
Do you think there's anything to the fact that his last name is French and therefore slightly evoking an outsider to an American community?
Maybe. A friend of a friend. The fact that he's also a plumber. Here to save the day. The Mario brothers were plumbers.
French Italian.
He's actually referred to as the plumber.
Well, I guess everyone in this small town is defined by their roles. And that's part of what makes Omar problematic, because there's no role to fit him into, and so the only available role is communist.
Is to label him as a threat.
They crossed the snow, up the ridge and onto the field. The little panel truck was parked halfway across the field. A heavy short man was sitting behind the wheel, smoking his pipe. He sat up as he saw the two of them coming toward him.
"Are you the one?"
he said to Conger. "Yes, thanks for warning me." The plumber shrugged.
"I don't know anything about this. Laura says you're all right."
He turned around.
"It might interest you to know some more of them are coming. Not to warn you, just curious."
"More of them?" Conger looked toward the town. Black shapes were picking their way across the snow.
People from the town. You can't keep this sort of thing quiet, not in a small town. We all listened to the police radio. They heard the same way Laura did. Someone tuned in, spread it around.
The shapes were getting closer. Conga could make out a couple of them. Bill Willett was there, with some boys from the high school. The Appletons were along, hanging back in the rear.
Even Ed Davies, Conga murmured.
The storekeeper was toiling onto the field with three or four other men from the town.
All curious as hell, French said. Well, I guess I'm going back to town. I don't want my truck shot full of holes. Come on, Laura.
She was looking up at Conga, wide-eyed.
Come on, French said again. Let's go. You sure as hell can't stay here, you know.
Why?
There may be shooting. It's what they all came to see. You know that, don't you, Conga? Yes. You have a gun. Or don't you care?
French smiled a little.
They picked up a lot of people in their time, you know. You won't be lonely.
The truck drove away, Laura sitting stiff and silent, frightened now. Conga watched for a moment. Then he dashed back into the woods, between the trees, towards the ridge. He could get away, of course. Anytime he wanted to, he could get away. All he had to do was leap into the crystal cage and turn the handles. But he had a job, an important job. He had to be here, here at this place, at this time. He reached the cage and opened the door. He went inside and picked up the gun from the shelf. The Slem gun would take care of them. He notched it up to full count. The chain reaction from it would flatten them all, the police, the curious, sadistic people. They wouldn't take him. Before they got him, all of them would be dead. He would get away. He would escape. By the end of the day, they would all be dead if that was what they wanted. And he saw the skull.
He's wondering which person is going to be the founder, and he looks around and sees that they're gathered like vultures, eager to see someone get killed. So death is really on the cards. We've got skulls, we've got vultures, we've got guns.
Pitchfork-wielding townsfolk.
Yeah. It's all coming to a head.
At this point, he really has to make a decision because his mission is to kill the person, the founder, before they utter a word, before they say anything prophetic. So it's quite a difficult situation to be in. He's got to shoot first. Who does he shoot? Who is this person? You won't know until they speak. But if they've spoken, it'll be too late.
That sounds like a paradox, Phil.
It does. But with the aid of a time machine, you can correct that. Like in 12 Monkeys. You can keep on going, fixing your own mistakes. The time travel in 12 Monkeys seemed a lot more painful than this one, though.
There's the slight problem in that he's completely surrounded by people who want to kill him. So if he dies, he dies. He can't get to his time machine anymore. So that does raise the stakes a little bit. And he certainly has his Slem gun ready for action.
And he's had a quiet moment to himself in the crystal booth to contemplate mortality. Come to grips with the pointlessness of it all. The infinite futility of time and existence.
So he has to decide, does he make a break for it? Does he kill everyone and be done with it? Or does he try and fulfill the mission the way he'd originally planned, which was to pick off the founder before he speaks, or she speaks?
I say he pulls out and nukes it from orbit. It's the only way to be sure.
There's nothing that says he doesn't come to that conclusion. There's a point where he's noting that he'll escape, and if they wanted to attack him, they'll all end up dead. But it is at that very point that he picks up the skull again. Bum 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 bum. Shocking revelation.
Suddenly he put the gun down. He picked up the skull. He turned the skull over. He looked at the teeth. Then he went to the mirror. He held the skull up, looking in the mirror. He pressed the skull against his cheek. Beside his own face, the grinning skull leered back at him. Beside his skull, against his living flesh. He bared his teeth, and he knew. It was his own skull that he held. He was the one who would die. He was the founder.
So what he realizes is you can't escape death. He's the founder. It says he realizes he's held his own skull in his hands. He sipped chocolate with a girl born before his time. he's done all these things, but he's still gonna, he's gonna die eventually, however it happens.
Some very religious overtones here. On the hill, people casting stones.
Well, yes, they do throw a stone at him and say, toss a bomb back, go on. Heckle him.
I think Omar is actually the antithesis of religion. He's been sent back, he's a non-believer. He's been sent on a mission by a group of scientists who are there to essentially nullify the existence of religion before it starts. He is the Antichrist.
He's the Antichrist, but then he realizes that, and I quote, by a strange twist of science, great phrase, that he will be reborn. When through time travel he's seen alive again, a few months later, after his bones had been buried under the floor of the jail. So he decides to step into the role of the founder.
A police car came on the edge of the field and stopped. The people retreated a little. Conger raised his hands. I have an odd paradox for you, he said. Those who take lives will lose their own. Those who kill will die. But he who gives his own life away will live again. They laughed, faintly, nervously. The police were coming out, walking toward him. He smiled. He had said everything he intended to say. It was a good little paradox he had coined. They would puzzle over it, remember it. Smiling, Conger awaited a death foreordained.
There's a bit of an analogy to writing. In the face of being acutely aware of your own death and insignificance, or his own death and insignificance, he comes up with a cool paradox that he's quite proud of, that he knows will outlast him.
But it doesn't in many ways, because the original words of the founder were lost in reinterpretation over time. What actually was remembered was the initial martyrdom. No one actually remembered what he said.
Right, so his words acted as a small spark, say from a malfunctioning lighter that grew into
a chain reaction of belief and faith. Well, what was initially a quirky little paradox grew into something that actually had more significance and was perpetuated by man for generations and generations over centuries. What he said was essentially not that important. It was the idea of it, the idea that someone had said something, and it was important, that gave the movement its power. Which casts an interesting light on many religions, really. It gives us an insight into Philip K. Dick's attitude towards the concept of religion.
At least at that time, I think his stance maybe changes through time, but certainly at this stage.
Maybe he hasn't suffered from hallucinations yet.
What, Phil, do you think this is saying about this dichotomy between science and religion that occurred at the very beginning, that he was sent to erase in the favour of science and the elite?
One take that one could read into this is that science and religion are intrinsically linked, and that a curiosity about the unknown is the commonality between both movements. One begets the other. Through the sequence of these events in this story, science definitely gives rise to religion. Religion gave rise to science. They are essentially one and the same, it's just the approach is different.
Yeah, it's the symbol of the worm swallowing its own tail.
Yeah. It's a human acceptance of the unknown. And a willingness to accept change.
And not to use your slam gun willy-nilly.
Absolutely. Because you never know which person is going to be the founder. But did you contemplate taking them all out, just to be sure?
Bit of light, bit of dark. What did you think of this tale? Did you enjoy it?
I did, I thought it was great. The idea of time travel and altering history is something that reoccurs throughout all kinds of science fiction, literary science fiction, movies, television shows, Doctor Who. Time paradoxes are really interesting. Time travel is such a wonderfully rich and diverse place to set anything. It's really like a science fiction writer's favorite toy, a comfort blanket. It's a nice place to go back to. It's malleable. It's really like the blue tack of writing. You can make so much of it. You can play with so many ideas. You always end up coming back to the milk bar.
The fountain. The fountain of youth.
There may be hoverboards or there may be scooters with skates, but there is always some dumb hick there trying to beat down your ass.
And, comfortingly enough, there's also the seeds of romance and hot chocolate with whipped cream. Yeah, I think it's a solid start to what is clearly going to be a recurring theme. I think it sits with you. I've after reading this, spent a bit of time imagining that final moment. It certainly is not without its cheesiness. It just has a very strong presence. It's easy to imagine. It's very simple whilst opening out into a world of complexity, which makes it like a very nice, pleasing puzzle.
It does, and it's an examination of the individual versus the group and how history unfolds. When we start to talk about Omar Khayyam, who is a Persian scientist, mathematician, who just happened to be quite poetic, his words tended to resonate through that little scenario. A 16-year-old girl is aware of this writer. Just a few little things here and there that talk about how things are timeless and how man's life is futile and unfortunately insignificant in the big scheme of things. Something that both science and religion acknowledge.
That idea of human insignificance dovetails nicely into the whole kind of tradition of weird fiction. I certainly makes me think of H.P. Lovecraft, who bases most of his, he came a bit earlier, but had that exploration of worlds between myth and science, and bases it on the idea that the human role in all these cosmic forces is fairly small. This is almost an inversion of that, because the smallness in comparison with the stream of time, the awareness of that actually produces a very strong ripple in the experience of humanity.
So it's not necessarily the human form or the physical form of humanity, it's the ideas behind humanity, and the idea that can be brought about by an individual can resonate through hundreds and thousands of individuals, using humanity as a medium as opposed to just an individual person.
Well, I think on that note we can quite happily close The Skull. For Philip K. Dick's third published story, it's certainly feeling strong, feeling like some interesting themes are emerging. Next week is The Little Movement.
We'll wind you up for that one.